Hi, Paul Merriman here, and this week I want to do something different with our podcast. I am thrilled to share with you a recording of a presentation by Mark Holbert at this year's AAII National Conference in Las Vegas in October. I attended his presentation, and when I heard it, I just thought, this is something I want our listeners to hear. And the people at AAII have been kind enough to let us have this particular podcast, this recording, and I hope you find it as interesting as I. Now, I'm going to warn you right off. When I first heard it, and I was there in the room, and they were showing the slides to go along with this presentation, it all made great sense. And as I say, I was excited to share it with you. But I love numbers. I love statistics. I love hard evidence. And when I listened to it for the second time, and this was true of a lot of the several of the other people in our organization, what happened was we all agreed that for some of you who don't like numbers, trying to put his presentation together with the PowerPoint or the slides might be more than you want to do. So I will tell you that I listened to it and found it very interesting and understandable just from the presentation itself without the slides. In fact, I listened to it once and then just reviewed the slides afterwards, and I found that to be to work pretty well. Now, this presentation starts with about a five-minute introduction from John Barkowski, who's the president of AAII. Mark is a very special person in the industry. As a matter of fact, I'm working on a series for next year about truth tellers. I've got 10 truth tellers that I want to dig into and get you to know more about their work, and they are people that I admire, that I trust, that I think tell the investing story in a way that is truly in your best interest. And certainly, Mark Holbert is one of those 10. And you will hear on in his presentation that he's been awarded for his commitment to investor education. Now, in this particular piece, he's talking about lessons learned from four decades independently tracking investor advisors' performance. And he has a lot of what I think is fascinating information about it and great lessons that come out of it. I'm going to give you the lessons ever so quickly. And then I want you to understand that the way he presents the information is very different from the way I teach some of these same subjects. But I love all of the solid evidence he uses. First one is beating the market is far more a matter of luck than it is skill. Secondly, our emotions make matters even worse. Third, patience and discipline are virtues. Four, risk is far greater than we assume. You'll find this fascinating, I'm sure, which leads to the next one, five, keep risk low. And then finally, judging an advisor is more complicated than a matter of statistics alone. I do hope you find this information as interesting as I do. And what I'm going to do is, in my next podcast, next week, I'm going to do basically a Q&A podcast, but I'm going to throw in my comments, what I took away from Mark's presentation that was special for me. I mentioned in last week's newsletter that I find the organization, the American Association of Individual Investors, to be a great source of education, and I hope that you'll go to AAII.org. And just look at the links across the top of that page and all the kinds of information that you can accumulate for $29 a year. And as I think I said in the newsletter, I'll be in Santa Barbara. I'll be in Milwaukee. I'll be in Madison. I'll be in LA. And I've been talking to Charleston. I'll likely be in Charleston later in 2019. Hope to see you come out and join us at one of those presentations. But in the meantime, enjoy the great work of Mark Hulbert. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Lessons Learned from Four Decades of Independently Tracking Investment Advisors Performance by Mark Hulbert of Hulbert Ratings.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage AAII President and CEO, John Bykowski.
Good morning. Still morning, I believe, here in West Coast time anyway. Hope everybody's having a wonderful luncheon and enjoying the various exhibits and presentations we've been putting on these past day and a half now. Back in 1978, James Clunan founded the American Association of Individual Investors to assist you guys in becoming more effective managers of your assets and being able to realize your financial dreams. Over the years, we've helped over 2 million individuals realize their financial wealth. And I'd like to take a moment now to actually thank many of the people that are actively involved in your organization and putting our mission forward. This face-to-face, person-to-person education is a wonderful way to learn from each other. And really, it's our local chapter leaders that are out there throughout the country putting on programs like this throughout the course of the year. I'd like to take a moment to really ask them to stand up for a moment and just give a round of applause to our local chapter leaders. If you wouldn't mind standing here for a moment. These are all local volunteers, and they do this out of their love for interacting with other members, their desire for knowledge, and their desire and wish to really help everyone become a better investor and become a realization of their dreams. So we've helped over 2 million people over the years. Right now, we have approximately 178,000 active AAI members. And quite a few of them are actually lifetime members, people who have thought enough about the organization to have it actually invested and taken a lifetime commitment to being involved in this group. And again, I'd like to thank this group as well. And I'm kind of curious, and I know that you guys have been sitting all morning and you're going to be sitting here for a wonderful presentation shortly. If you wouldn't mind standing up, this is a little bit of exercise here. How many lifetime members do we actually have at our conference here today? I'd like to thank you all for your, wow. I think you're all here, and I thank you so much for putting your trust in us. I was having a conversation earlier today, and we see so many faces at this conference year to year. And as one more group, I know I've been asking people to stand up and disrupt your lunch here. I'm kind of curious. How many people here are here at a conference for the very first time ever? If you wouldn't mind, that's quite a show of hand. Well, hopefully this won't be your last conference visit. In fact, we've got one coming up next year in Orlando. So if you do want to, if you are enjoying this moment, please tell your friends and please consider coming to that as well. So as I was saying, James Clunan launched the organization back in 1978. And just 2 years after that, our upcoming speaker launched his service. When our founder, James Clunan, was retiring, we were interviewing him for an article in the journal. And we asked him, you know, is there anybody or any entity or group or person that really you saw had an important impact on benefiting individual investors and making the whole environment that investors compete in and get knowledge from better? And without blinking, he quickly mentioned Mark Hulbert. He goes, Mark Hulbert has worked tirelessly over the years to bring honesty to an industry that is known for excessive claims and puffery. He is probably single-handedly kept information brokers accountable for what they do. And he started this back in 1980. He's been running his publication through, I think, 2016. He has still actually, even though he's not publishing the Hubbard Financial Digest anymore, he's actually still contacting the newsletters and keeping track of their information. And he's reporting on it in the many articles that he publishes. He writes for Barron's, Wall Street Journal, MarketWatch, regular columnist. In fact, I was praising him because I was reading an article, I believe it was a week or so ago, and he was he correctly noted and warned us as investors that a correction is coming. Now, he's going to be modest. He's going to say, oh, I was talking about the possibility of a correction, and the headline writers made it sound better. But Mark Hulbert is an astute student of the marketplace. He always has interesting columns to write. He's always educating us. He's helping us become better investors. And 5 years ago, the association thought it was important to honor people that go out of their way to improve the investment education of individual investors. And would you please honor me and welcome Mark Hulbert up to the stage. I'm going to present him with the Clunan Award for Investment Education.
My goodness.
I have another microphone for
you. Okay.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you so much for all the work you've done. And I look forward to many more years of your insightful contribution.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I'm very honored to be here before you and to accept the Clunan Prize for Investor Education. And insofar as I have any honor in this regard, it's by standing on the shoulders of people like Jim Clunan. And I really think it's worth taking a couple seconds to remember how much the world has changed since the late 1970s when he started the organization. It's a hallmark of great social innovations, I think, that people, as soon as something like AAII is created, that we think, of course, and we feel as though it's been here forever. But it's not. And back in the late 70s, the notion of providing unbiased education to investors was revolutionary. And Jim had that vision. In fact, I was thinking about it, the primary source for investor information for investors back there was probably an 8-minute monologue on Friday nights by Louis Rukeyser on public television. There was no computer, no internet, none of the sources that we take for granted. And look around now, this is what we have. So congratulations to Jim, congratulations to the organization, and my thank you for inviting me in with this honor. So I have just under 50 minutes to talk to you about lessons I've learned from tracking investment advisors for the last 4 decades. As I think you'll find out, I have a lot more lessons than I have minutes, so I'm going to go through it very quickly, hopefully giving us time for a Q&A at the end and any discussions. I will tell you up front that the pedagogical strategy I have when I talk about lessons is to be intentionally provocative. I may go a little bit too far in stating them, but it's a way of getting a discussion going, because that in the end is where we can provide the best education. So what I've been doing over the last 40 years, as many of you already know, is I've objectively tracked the performance of hundreds of investment advisors. And I've done this just by constructing model portfolios according to the advice provided by those advisors. And at the conceptual level, that's all I've done. It's a very easy job. They do all the hard work, and I just do what they tell me to do. I've set up a simulation of the quote-unquote real world on my computers. I get data feeds from all the exchanges, and I just execute the trades as they are given to me and let the chips fall where they may. And I've been doing that, as I say, since 1980. Very few advisors that were around in 1980 are around today, and most of the advisors that are around today weren't around in 1980, but we don't throw away any data, so there's no survivorship bias or hindsight bias in our data, and it's a fairly, I think, impressive database on which to test what really has worked in the market as opposed to what has not. And it's on the basis of that data I want to talk about a various number of investment lessons today. I, of course, just to mention, take commissions, dividends, splits, and so forth into taking into account. And even though my newsletter is no longer, as John was mentioning, you can see the scoreboards for the investment advisors I do track for free at my newsletter's website now, called HulbertRatings.com. So it used to be that the lesson that I would start out with when I would talk about what I've learned over the last 40 years was how few advisors beat the market. Harold Pollack, in his very excellent presentation yesterday, was pointing this out. It's something that we all know to be true. I think the statistic that Harold mentioned is that over 10 years, only 2% or something of actively managed mutual funds end up beating the market. I've decided not to make that one of the investment lessons I draw, because really it doesn't matter, I think, that few advisors beat the market if they can continue to beat the market in the future. If we go out, let's say, and created a random group out of this crowd to play baseball against the Houston or LA Dodgers, we'd lose every time. But that doesn't mean that there isn't genuine ability out there. The question is, can a period's winners, whether it's in baseball or investing, continue to be a winner in the subsequent period? And that's what I want to talk about. So let's look first at return persistence over a one-year horizon. So this is, again, based on my database going back 40 years for the investment newsletters I track. So I don't know whether you can see all of the words up there, but I'll tell you what the axes measure. So I'm going to have two columns here in a minute. And one is those advisors that are in the top quartile of the market in a given year. So that means they're in the top 25% in a ranking of newsletters. And now on the vertical axis, I want to see what percentage of them are in the top quartile for the subsequent year. So randomly, if you pick advisors out of a group that is totally an unbiased sample, you'd expect 25% of them, just on the basis of randomness alone, that they would be in the top quartile. So guess what? So if you look at the percent of advisors who are in the top quartile in year one, it turns out that they are only 20% of them are in the top quartile in the second year. That's even worse than you'd expect on the basis of randomness alone. And it turns out that among the losers, the bottom quartile, they actually are better than 25%. So if you have only piece of information you had was whether an advisor was in the top quartile or the bottom quartile, you really would have greater odds of success by going with an advisor in the bottom quartile than you would by going with one in the top quartile. Now, because I am worried about time, I am going to quickly go through these others. I do the same thing at 3 years and 10 years. So it turns out that the same pattern emerges when you're looking at a 3-year and a 10-year horizon. So what's going on? Clearly, randomness and luck are playing a big role, but there's something else, and I want to talk about that, because the results are even worse than you'd expect if the world were purely random. So what is that? And I think it really has to do with separating luck from skill as the first step for trying to figure out what's going on. Now, of course, it's notoriously difficult to separate luck from skill, but there have been several attempts that I think are worth mentioning. One of them is a guy whose name I'm sure I'm going to butcher because I don't know French, but Michael Maubassin, who used to be actually at Legg Mason Value Trust and now then went to Credit Suisse, and now I think he has his own firm. But he had a book that I highly recommend called The Success Equation, and the subtitle is Untangling Skill and Luck in Business, Sports, and Investing. Fascinating book. Even if you have no interest in the investment world, he does the same for sports and business and finds that there's still a huge issue. And how do you separate luck from skill? His insight is that you can measure skill or luck by the speed with which a track record reverts to the mean. So a coin flip is a good way of thinking about this. If you flip a heads on round one, what are the odds it'll come up heads the second time? Is exactly 50-50. There's absolutely no difference in your probability in the second round than in the first. That's the definition of pure luck. Whereas if I'm playing a chess grandmaster in chess, I'll lose every time. There's no regression to the mean. That's a paradigmatic example of pure skill. So what I found, this is a fascinating chart, which I'm going to go through at some length because I think it's incredibly revealing. So what on the bottom axis there, and again, I'm sorry, I'm sure you can't read all of what the axis labels are saying, But on the bottom axis, the horizontal axis, I have 10 columns, or will have 10 columns, each reflecting a decile for performance in a given year. So I take all the advisors I have followed in a given year and I put them into 10 groups according to their performance. The top 10% are in decile 1, the next 10% are in decile 2, all the way down to decile number 10. And then I look to see what deciles they are in year number 2. If there were persistence, you'd expect that the average percentile rank of the top decile, the ones that were between 90 and 100 in year 1, their average percentile rank in year 2 would be 95, halfway between 90 and 100. The second one would have an average percentile rank of 85 and so forth. So in a pure skill world, that's what it would look like, right? It would be monotonically decreasing from 95 down to 5 across all 10 deciles. The green bars would be a world in which it's pure skill, right? That what your decile rank in year number 1 has absolutely nothing to do with your rank in year number 2. So that's the background. Now I'm going to give you the data in a moment. And the question that you have to ask yourself upon looking at this data is it closer to the pure skill or the pure luck end of the extreme? And of course, it is very close to the pure skill end of the extreme. In fact, the only time in which you see a significant difference between what you'd expect on the basis of pure randomness and the actual results is at the bottom of the distribution. So if you're in the 10th decile in year number 1, you actually have an above average chance of being a bad performer in year number 2. On those periods in which I'm honestly self-reflecting on the social good I might have produced over the last 40 years, it's something along the lines of, I have kept people from investing with the awful advisors. So the Joe Granvilles, rest in peace, would not have been somebody you would follow if you were tracking my data. But saying that I've helped you avoid the awful advisors doesn't have a real sexy ring to it, does it? And it turns out that is a modest social goal. I think it is a worthwhile goal, but nonetheless, it's a rather modest one. But for all other deciles besides the bottom 1 or possibly the bottom 2, there's no statistically significant difference in what you'd expect from randomness and what you actually see. The regression to the mean, in other words, is almost immediate. That's the paradigmatic example of what Maubuisson said is the definition of something for which luck is predominant. There's also a way of measuring it statistically. When you correlate the percentile rank in year T with all the newsletters' ranks in year T plus 1 across all portfolios in all years since 1980, so that's more than 12,000 pairs, the R squared was 1.7% on a scale of 1 to 100. So basically, your rank in year number 1 explains 1.7% of your rank in year number 2. Big deal. I would love it. It'd be great for my business to be able to tell you that the R squared was 75 or 80 or 95. You know, then I'd be mobbed with subscriptions, right? But unfortunately, truth wins the day, and this is what the truth is. And it's a very humbling piece of truth. So there's another approach to separating luck from skill that I think is worth mentioning. It comes from a guy at UCLA, Brad Cornell. And his approach, I think, is very simple. You simply compare the variance of returns over shorter and longer periods among the same group of advisors. So let's say you take 100 advisors and rank them for their performance over year 1. They're going to be all over the map, right? Because we know that luck has a big role in performance over a year's time. But then let's say you look at a 20-year period for those same advisors. On the assumption that those same advisors have the same degree of skill over the 20 years as the 1 year, if you look at the variance of returns over a 20-year period, you'd expect them to be in a much tighter distribution. There's going to be a convergence of their returns. That difference, he says, is a reflection of the degree to which luck plays a role. What did he find? So he looked at Morningstar's database of large cap mutual funds. He found that 92% of the cross-sectional variation in annual performance is attributable to random chance. He gave me the formula he used. I applied it to newsletters and came up with almost identical numbers for newsletters. So I love this line from Ben Graham, which is a way of articulating this lesson that I'm taking way too long to try to articulate to you. But read it with me. One lucky break or one supremely shrewd decision, and then this is the most revealing part of the sentence, can we tell them apart, may count for more than a lifetime of journeyman's efforts. And this is part of the story that I think is so revealing. Graham was referring to his investment in Geico, and many of you may know this history. But he invested in Geico back, I think it was in the late 40s, early 50s, but it was very early on. And he held onto it and invested more to the point where his investment in Geico broke almost all of his major investment rules. If you read The Intelligent Investor, he says never do X, never do Y, never do Z, and he broke all of them with Geico. Geico was a growth stock near the end of his career. It wasn't a value stock. It represented a huge percentage of his portfolio. He was on the board when he said you shouldn't have that kind of relationship with the companies you're investing in. I mean, he broke all these rules, and yet Geico represented more profits than all other investments he made combined over his entire career. If but for Geico, I don't think we would ever hear or even know who Ben Graham was. That's how important Geico was. And so it was at a subsequent edition of The Intelligent Investor that Graham put this sentence that I quote there at the top. He put this addendum because people were pointing out, well, what about Geico? And he has this extraordinary admission that one lucky break or one supremely shrewd decision may count for more than a lifetime of journeyman efforts. And believe me, I know from speaking to many AAI chapters, you are all very hard workers. You're some of the most industrious at looking at the data and trying to plow through it. You all have had a lifetime of journeyman efforts. And to be told by Ben Graham that one lucky break can make more difference than all those efforts has to be pretty sober. So the question I like to leave us with before I go on to my next lesson is how many other Ben Grahams have lived whose outsized bet on one company didn't work out? We'll never know, will we? Since we never hear about them. So lesson number one, just to summarize before I go on to lesson number two, is beating the market is far more a matter of luck than it is of skill. Okay, negative skill. I want to talk about this one other factor. You remember when I was looking at that return persistence chart at the beginning, we found that actually it was worse than random, right? So there has to be something else besides luck going on, because luck, by definition, over time will balance itself out. So the fact that you're consistently worse than random suggests there's some other factor. I'll call it negative skill. Okay, so this is a chart that actually Harold Pollack mentioned yesterday, which I'll just mention more briefly than I would have otherwise. But basically, it's a study that Terry O'Dean at UC Berkeley did, where he got data on 64,000 brokerage accounts. And what he did, among many things, this fascinating research project that was launched when he got access to the data. But the thing that I want to focus on is this. What he did is he looked at any time any one of those accounts sold a stock and then bought another within 30 days' time. The assumption he made, which seems totally unobjectionable, is that if you buy another stock within 30 days of selling one, the one you buy is thought to be a replacement for the one you sell, and implicitly you're assuming it's going to do better than the one you just sold, right? So what he did is he then created pairs, the sold and then the subsequent replacement buy, and he looked at their performance over the next quarter, year, and 2 years' time. He didn't include taxes. He didn't include commissions. He's simply looking at the raw price performance of the stocks sold relative to the stocks bought. So I'm going to give a bar chart. If it's positive, that means the bought stock did better, which is what you hope, right? If it's negative, it means that the bought stock did less well than the one. Well, guess what? So over a three-month period, actually it's 4 months, a third of the year, the stocks that were bought did 1.5 percentage points less than the ones that you had just sold. So in other words, if you had held on to the stock, average of all these investors, had simply held on to the stock that you sold, you would be 1.5% better plus taxes and commissions. Over a year's time, it's now down between 3% and 3.5%. And it's even worse, 2 years, it's above 3.5%, between 3.5% and 4%. This cannot be accounted for by randomness. And what Harold mentioned yesterday is right. This is where our emotions take over. We don't want to hold on to certain stocks and we want to buy others, and most of the time our emotions lead us astray. Here's another illustration that the average thing we do is a mistake. Consider what would happen if on New Year's Day every day we simply froze into place what our portfolio was at that time and did nothing for the remainder of the year. Then at the end of the year, you look at that frozen portfolio relative to your actual portfolio. If you're trading added value, you should be better off than you would have been had you simply froze that portfolio from New Year's Day. So, okay, I did this for newsletters, and then I found access to an academic study that did the same for mutual funds. So, newsletters, it turns out that the frozen portfolios did about 0.72, 72 basis points better on average than the actual portfolios. So the cost on average across all the newsletters in my database of their trading was 72 basis points. Among mutual funds, it was even worse. It was close to 80 basis points. Another measure of what is beyond simply luck to being something that we are systematically doing as an investment public, we're buying when we should be selling, and we're selling when we should be buying. So lesson number two, emotions make matters worse. So things get worse from here, by the way. I have six lessons, and then we're already in lesson two. So luck is a predominant factor in investment performance, and then our emotions make it even worse than that, if possible, right? Okay, so now lesson number three I want to talk about is the limits of statistics, which again, people think is an odd thing for me to reflect upon, since basically that's all I've spent my career doing is trying to compile the statistics of investment performance. But follow along with me. If skill plays only a small role in investment performance, we are going to need an enormous amount of data over a very long period of time to determine that an advisor is truly skillful and not just lucky. Right? If you're a grandmaster in chess and you win 10 rounds in a row against a number of takers, all of whom are ranked, you can be pretty confident that you're not bad at chess, right? But in the market, if skill plays such a predominant role, you're going to need a lot more than 10 years of data, even if you beat the market, to be able to conclude at anything close to standard levels of statistical significance that you've actually have skill and not just mere luck. Here's the corollary. Once you've chosen an advisor, it takes an enormous amount of data to conclude that the advisor has lost his or her touch. So both of those are just different sides of the same coin. So consider, I want to use a current example, momentum stocks. So the strategy has been one of the very best back to 1926 of any of the ones that get an academic seal of approval, right? Yet over the last decade, it has barely made any money even before transaction costs. Is this decade-long period of underperformance enough to conclude that momentum has stopped working? So here's the chart. This is a chart where the line shows the trailing 10-year return of momentum stocks. Notice that it comes down to almost zero at the very right, which is the up to recently. There were points in several decades ago when the returns were huge. So if you look at that chart, would you say, is that enough to conclude that momentum has stopped working? Well, there are a number of statistical tests you can apply to this. And the answer is no. At that standard level of statistical significance, you cannot conclude that the data series since that inflection point, which is 2009, is different than what came before. So what that means is if you're a momentum follower and you've had frustrating returns for 10 years, the best answer that a statistician can tell you is, well, you know, you need to keep your nose to the grindstone and keep following the discipline that you got underway. Think about the commitment that's required. Most of us get rid of an advisor after a year or two, or not even that much sometimes, of bad performance, or that depersonalize it and focus on a strategy. We'll get rid of a strategy after a very short period of time. That may be the right thing to do, but you can't justify that on the basis of the statistics alone. If you want to be statistically driven and more than just intuition, you need to stick with whatever strategy you have or advisor for a lot longer. So there's two ways of putting this. One is you could say, or maybe it comes to the same thing, but the choice of an advisor is closer to a marriage than it is to a one-night stand. And most of us, maybe you guys are all exceptions, but most of the world considers it to be the latter. If you haven't done anything for me lately, even if you've had an outstanding performance over the 5-year, 10-year period prior to this last year, but if it's not working this year, you're out of here, right? Turns out that a corollary of that is that extrapolating the past is very, very tricky. All too often, we will project a strategy's average return into the future, but not its volatility. But the volatility is just as important in trying to project what the future will be like as the average return. So even if the future is like the past, the strategy could produce a dramatically different result. And I owe that lesson to a really fascinating piece. It's in the current issue of the Financial Analyst Journal by Fama and French, and it's called Volatility Lessons. And I'll go through a couple of examples, but it's free. The FAJ has put it on the free part of their site, so I would recommend any of you go out and look at it. It's a fascinating article. So one of the illustrations that Fama and French go through is they want to project the equity premium. Now, the equity premium is the return of the stock market return less the return of, let's say, a risk-free rate of return. In their case, they use 90-day T-bills. So the amount that you earn above and beyond what you could in riskless cash, right? So what they assumed is that each month in the future, the equity premium would be equal to what it was in a randomly picked month from the last 50 years. So this is, they're just imitating a standard statistical technique. Let's see, you have a bucket with 640 months in it, 640 slips of paper, and on each one of those pieces of paper is what the equity premium was on a different month over the last 50 years. Each month you draw out a piece of paper and say, that's why equity premium that month, put it back in. Next month you draw another one out. They did that 100,000 times, and then they looked at the number of 10-year or 5, 10, 15, 20-year periods in which the equity premium was negative. So what the bottom, again, I'll show you I'll go over what the labels are. The bottom axis, the horizontal one, looks at 1, 3, 5, 10, and 20, and 30-year horizons. And the vertical axis is the percentage of time in which those 100,000 simulations produced a negative result. So over a one-year period of time, the possibility of a negative equity premium, not a big shocker, is maybe 36-37%. And we know that, so that in a given year, we don't expect always to outperform T-bill rate. But look at it, even at a 10-year period, it's between 15 and 20%. At the 30-year horizon, it's between 5 and 10%. So what assurance, even if the future is exactly like the past, is what the point Ken French made. When I talked to him earlier, he said, even if the future is exactly like the past, and you can raise all kinds of questions about whether the future will be like the past, but even if you assume it is, a big if, volatility alone means you have to expect a good percentage of 5 and 10-year periods in which you're going to do less well than treasury bills. Same for the value premium, which is the yellow vertical bar there. Look at the percentage of time that the value premium is negative over a 10-year period. It's over 10%. The reason that that's relevant today is that the value premium has been negative over the last 10 years. And so there's been no end of speculation as to whether the value premium no longer holds. The value premium is the fact that value stocks historically have beaten growth stocks. But over the last 10 years, growth stocks have beaten value. And you have all kinds of hypotheses being advanced that maybe book to market is no longer a good measure of value. Any of a number of things about maybe the discount rate is no longer a great factor for valuing stocks. Any of a number of theories, right? But it turns out that what if the explanation is, you know what, it was just a luck of the draw. The period back to 1926, which was the basis of the FAMA French data that gave us the value premium, the value effect in the first place, that just represented one of those 100,000 draws in the simulation. It happened to be a particularly good one. And even if you assume the future is just as good, no, this is just the luck of the draw. It's so hard for us to accept that we've invested and over a 10-year period we've lost money. And somebody like me gets up and says, that's just bad luck, sorry about that. But that's the way the world is. Now look at small caps. Small caps have greater probability of a negative return relative to large caps. Over the 30-year horizon even, it's a 15% probability that you'll have a 30-year holding period in which you would have been better off holding large cap stocks. So lesson number three, if I just can try to put a bow on top of all of that, is that patience and discipline are virtues. When I interviewed French, I'm writing an article about this very topic for the Wall Street Journal, he said, it's not that I'm giving up on the value effect, by no means. He is very much a believer in the value effect. He's very much a believer in the small cap effect. So don't interpret this lesson about volatility as giving up on the underlying data. He's willing to project that the future will be like the past within appropriate tolerances. But rather, he said, we take the past and project the average, the mean, into the future and forget about the volatility of the returns. Another lesson I want to talk about is that risk grows with the investment horizon. This is the assumption behind almost all financial plans, right? We're said that, well, yes, that things can be a little rocky now, like the last couple weeks, for example, in the market, but if we hold on long enough, things will be okay, right? How many times have we heard that? Well, what if that's not the case? What if we don't have any guarantee that the future will work out? We'd like it to be, but hope is not an investment strategy. Consider all the forces that could prevent the equity premium over the next 30 years from equaling its historical average. And I don't have to enumerate, but you can imagine all the things that could get in the way of that, right? The ones currently have to do with, you can imagine, from climate change to trade wars to nuclear war to any of a number of terrible scenarios. Why do we have this innate confidence that things will always work out? Well, it turns out there's ways of measuring this. I'm going to go over that. Now, Jeremy Siegel, of course, disagrees with me in this regard, and a number of other people have advanced it. This is the famous chart that he has in his book, that if you hold for a 30-year, the standard deviation of returns is right around 2%. Yes, over a one-year period of time, the standard deviation is huge, but it declines monotonically all the way up to that 30-year. That's the assumption behind all the financial plans. But let's look at climate change a little more closely. And I'm not taking a position here. Many people think that I'm trying to take one side or the other. Let's just assume that the debate is not completely settled. And consider first the range of possible economic consequences to climate change over the coming 12 months. Well, the difference between the most dire scenario and the most benign is virtually undetectable at a one-year horizon, right? But now think of the range of possible outcomes over the next 30 or 50 years. If you believe some of the most dire scenarios, human life won't even be around, or it will be majorly different. So actually, the range of possible outcomes increases with the investment horizon. Why would we ever have thought that it was any other way? So there's a study, University of Chicago, a guy named Lubos Pastor and Wharton, a guy named Robert Stambaugh, where they came up with a very innovative approach statistically for measuring risk over long periods of time. And it's way beyond me to try to describe it to you, but basically what this chart does is it reflects a ratio of the variance, which is twice or square of the standard deviation. So it looks at the variance of returns at whatever horizon you want relative to what the variance is at 1 year. We already know the variance at 1 year is pretty high, right? Look at the ratio at 10 years. The ratio of 10-year variance to 1 year variance is 1.1, which is to say that when you expand your horizon out for 10 years, the range of possible outcomes is 10% greater than it already was at 1 year. Now look at 30 years. It's now 50% greater. So what the two of them, when I interviewed them about this, had to say is basically the last 200 years of U.S. stock market history represent one draw of a huge sample size that could have gone the other way, right? There was nothing preordained that the U.S. would win two world wars, that it would win the Cold War, that there'd be a huge, you know, geopolitical shift where we became the leader of the basically the major global power. In order to project the equity premium of the last 200 years into the future, we have to expect that the future will be equally kind to equities as it was over the last 200 years. And it has to all be a surprise, because if the market knew about it now, it wouldn't already be in stock prices. So we have to project that there are going to be as momentous things in the future, like two more world wars, and you name it, and all of them are going to fall in the U.S. direction, and that we don't know anything about any of them today. You put it that way, doesn't seem like quite as sure of a bet, does it? So lesson number four. I told you it was getting more depressing as I went on. Risk is far greater than we assume. As we go down this depression here, risk doesn't always pay off. Given the predominant role that luck plays in investment performance, it's crucial to keep risk low. This just follows because high risk will inevitably lead to losses so big that recovery becomes unlikely. So the next slide plots newsletters' returns over the last 20 years against the risk. Notice that once risk exceeds that of the overall market, there's a diminishing return. So the red vertical line reflects the stock market's risk. So any of those dots which represent newsletter returns to the right of that vertical line represent newsletters whose riskiness was greater than the market. The downwardly sloping green line is the best fit line. You just ask Excel to say, come up with the linear model that most fits those data points, and notice that it's downwardly sloping. In fact, there is a couple dots, again, I'm sure it's hard for you to see it from the very back, but are close to the market's vertical line there, which is to say about more or less the risk of the market as a whole, that are near the top, have the best returns over those 20-year periods. And they're not that much riskier than the market as a whole. So one way of looking at this chart is, why would you ever incur more risk than the market? Because you don't get any greater return than those two dots on that chart. And in fact, all of them that are a greater risk have lower returns. So this is just one way of showing that we don't automatically get higher returns for the higher risk. So lesson number five, as I zoom through these last lessons, is keep risk low. So now I want to talk about the limit of statistics again. A statistically superior strategy is of little value to you if you would be unwilling to follow it through thick and thin. This psychological dimension is all too often overlooked. And again, people find it odd that I'll focus on this because, again, I've spent my life focusing on statistics. I guess it's because my wife is a clinical psychologist that I bring in the psychology dimension. But it's so true. We often will be told that there's this great strategy out there, but we don't have the psychological wherewithal, either willingness or ability or tolerance, to be able to live with that through thick and thin. So what good does it do the client or to yourself to say this is something that you ought to do when in fact you won't do it? My wife has to deal with this all the time. There are certain things that would be absolutely better for her clients to do, but she also knows that the advice would not be followed. So what good does it do the client for her to tell them to do something when she knows they won't do it? So part of her challenge is to give them good advice that they'll actually follow. Another way of saying her job is to make them better. And it's similar in the investment world, right? Our job is to have investment success over a lifetime. And if a statistically superior strategy is not going to be followed, then what good is it? This all points to a different way of judging advisors' performance. So how many actually buy and hold? It's the rare investor, I maintain, who maintains a 100% equity exposure through a bear market, though I suspect there's a greater prevalence of that behavior in this room than in most groups of investors. But still, I'd say it's probably rare. There's this great quote from a guy named Claude Erb, who says, "The people who can truly stomach the volatility of a 100% stock portfolio are either catatonic or dead." So this leads me back to Ben Graham. Now I'm going to do it in a more favorable light. Ben Graham had this amazing, again, I think, amazing comment. "The best way to measure your investing success is not by whether you're beating the market, but by whether you've put in place a financial plan and a behavioral discipline that are likely to get you where you want to go." And the reason this is one of the lessons I like to end my remarks with is that I'm going to raise questions here. I'm not going to tell you what I think the right answer is, as if I would think I have the right answer anyway. But the reason is to ask the question of what is it that we should be comparing advisors' performance to? If buying and holding the market is something that few of us would be willing to do, then why are we comparing advisors against the market and dismissing them when they don't? So again, I don't mean to criticize Harold Pollack yesterday, but you know, he wrote off 98% of the mutual funds out there because they didn't beat the market. But what if, for whatever reason, those mutual funds, or some of them, had strategies that allowed people to be at least willing to adhere to them through a bear market in a way that an index fund wouldn't? I don't know what the answer is, but there's at least the possibility that a statistically inferior strategy would still be worth following if you actually follow it through thick and thin. The alternative, this is, some people actually have suggested this, the alternative against which advisors ought to be compared may be doing nothing. Now that may be going too far too, but I asked the question. And I also asked the following question, which I think is a very esoteric one, but might the market for investment advice be as efficient as the stock market? Now, the reason I ask that is that I've followed academic research on the market over the years, and it's amazing the degree to which a number of theoreticians will do backflips to explain away what otherwise looks like irrational behavior. And they say, oh, well, that's the market being efficient. And you don't really, in fact, there are many people who don't even have a good explanation for why value and small cap outperform, except to say they must be proxies for risk. That's the standard line. Well, why is it that it's more risky? I mean, any other of the standard ways of measuring that don't always come up with actual ways of showing that they're riskier. But nonetheless, we assume almost tautologically that they must be higher risk because otherwise, why would they produce higher returns? So we do these backflips to explain what otherwise looks to be irrational behavior and say that it's truly just another way of looking at the efficiency of the market. Maybe we should go through the same backflips with investment advisors. I asked the question. I don't know what the right answer is. But back to Ben Graham's point, if an advisor gets you to where you want to go, shouldn't you be happy? And if somebody like me comes along and says, oh, well, that advisor didn't beat the market, do you care? As I say, I just asked the question. My lesson, though, is a more benign one, is simply that judging an advisor is more complicated than a matter of statistics alone. So I have 7 minutes left in my allotted time, so I want to go through a corollary of my analysis, which leaves you with a little bit more hope than my otherwise depressing messages. And that has to do with contrarian analysis. If luck plays a predominant role, and indeed I think it does, and our emotions overreact by leading us to buy when we should be selling and selling when we should be buying, then it follows the following. On average, advisors will be wrong. as will be most of us individually. And this is exactly what contrarian analysis believes. So one way of measuring the extent to which emotions are working against us and luck plays a role in the markets is to see if contrarian analysis works. And it does. And our approach to analyzing contrarian analysis is different, but there are many, and one that, you already know about is the AAII Investor Survey. And when you run it through the same statistical test that I do with my data, they're very similar results. It's another way of saying is that it works. When people are extremely bearish, it's a good time to buy, and when people are extremely bullish, it's a good time to lighten up. So what we do is we track what advisors are doing as opposed to what they're saying. We simply average their recommended exposure levels in four different market arenas. We look at a broad market, then we look at NASDAQ timers in particular, then we look at the gold, and we look at bonds. And the specifics of what I measured, the charts on the following, I have overheads for each of those markets, and they segregate all of the readings. They take the 10% of the readings where they're most bullish, and 10% of the time when they are most bearish. And then I look at the return of the market over the subsequent week, month, quarter, and so forth to see if there is a difference in the return following periods of excessive optimism and excessive pessimism. So the first is the stock sentiment. This is the broad stock market sentiment versus the Dow. The orange line is the return following the 10% of days with the lowest amount of bullishness or the most bearishness. And the bottom blue line is the return following the most excessive bullish readings. You'll see there at the quarter, the three-month time horizon, is the maximum divergence, which is to say there's 2 percentage points on average in return difference between those two. The next chart, I look at the same sentiment relative to the Russell 2000. And the reason for that is that if indeed you believe the contrarian story, it's going to have a greater impact on the return of those stocks for which sentiment plays the bigger role, which are the smaller cap stocks, right? And sure enough, it turns out that instead of that 2.0 percentage point difference and spread between the most bullish and most bearish readings, it's now 4.3 percentage points at the one-quarter horizon, and it continues to grow. And at the six-month horizon, it's 5.2 percentage points difference between the returns following the most bullish and the most bearish readings. So contrarian analysis appears to work. In the gold market, the same thing. If anything, it's an even greater divergence. And again, I think that would follow a contrarian story. Depending on what you believe about gold, there's not a lot of fundamental basis for gold's valuation. So it's going to be, to that extent, more influenced by investor sentiment than it is anything else. And sure enough, look at the quarter time horizon, the difference between the most bullish and most bearish of readings among the gold market timers we track is 10.5 percentage points. What's interesting is I next do the same chart with, instead of the GDX, which is an ETF reflecting some of the more major gold market timers, the GDXJ, which reflects the junior gold market timers, which you'd think, according to contrarian theory, would be ones more influenced by sentiment. And sure enough, look at it, it's now up to 15.3 percentage points at the six-month horizon between the most bullish and the most bearish. Interestingly enough, I now do the same thing with the bond market, and it's the same as well. It was a little surprise. Bonds, you'd think, are the most influenced by huge bond market traders, where they'll trade huge amounts of money for just a basis point or two, and yet there is also the influence of sentiment in that market. You'll notice that at the six-month horizon, there's a 5.7 percentage point difference in the return of the TNX, which is the 10-year yield, between the most bullish and the most bearish of readings. I'll end you with where we are in our current sentiment so you can see where we are going out of here. So the first column shows what the bottom decile reading. So anything below, for example, the general stock market, anything below 3.3% negative, which is to say they're 3.3% short the market, would put them in the bottom decile. And anything above 59.6% positive exposure level would be putting them in the top decile. Our current reading is 20.5. Which is to say that it's neither in the most excessive decile, excessively bullish or bearish decile. I'm a little surprised that it's not more negative given what the market's done for the last couple of weeks, and therein lies a story, which I don't have time to go into. NASDAQ, you can see what the range is for the top and bottom deciles. We're actually among NASDAQ market timers very close to the upper bound of that bottom decile, which is to say that at least from that measure of sentiment, that we may be getting close to some of the excessive levels of bearish sentiment that you see accompanying some sort of a low. The gold market, just in contrast, is close to being in one of the excessively bullish readings, and then the bond market close to being in one of the excessively bearish readings, but not quite. So anyway, that ends, I think, I left myself a minute and 24 seconds. So I have some time now for questions more than this minute. We also gave 10 minutes for Q&A. I understand there are microphones that will be circulated around. So hold up your hand, a microphone will be coming. And we can see whether I have depressed you totally or whether I've gotten your argumentative juices going, which I love. Here, I'll repeat your question. Just yell it out to me. Yeah, the question is, if I'll see if I got it right, was that that you've heard it, I think by me, but others as well, perhaps, that if you were to hold your mutual fund when it's down at a loss rather than selling it, you'll probably be better off over time than selling it. And that is indeed what the data show. I mean, most of the time people sell at a time when they should probably buy. The data that I showed in the chart here, which was for stocks, where if you, the ones you bought tended to do worse than the ones you sold, applies to mutual funds as well. Does that mean you never sell? No, I mean, there are always extremes on these things that you can take these things that are unfair, but as a general rule, that's the case. Yeah.
Sure, so if I understand your charts on the last set of slides that you presented, the contrarians did better return-wise over those specific time frames than did the people who were bullish, irrespective of what the market did.
Oh, well, now let me, that's not quite right. So basically those, so the chart of performance following the 10% of the most bearish readings reflected a different time period than following the most bullish of readings. Because when they, I'm looking at on average across a whole sample of market timers, if they're excessively bearish, what does the market do? So let's say the point at which they become excessively bearish is day one. I look at what the market did for the next 30, 90, 180 days, right? There'll be a whole different period of time when they're excessively bullish, but the point at which they become excessively bullish. That becomes day one, and I look at what happens over the 30, 90, 180 days thereafter. And then I compare them, and it's still 190 or 30 days after the point at which it became excessively bullish or bearish, but they're not the same time period. Does that make sense? Yeah.
What about foreign markets and emerging markets?
What about, I'm sorry, what was the first, what about?
What about foreign stocks and emerging market stocks? Do you have research on that too?
The question is, what about foreign and emerging stocks? It turns out that every conclusion I had today would apply to those groups of stocks too. And there are plenty of newsletters that we track that have focused on them. I would not draw any separate distinction about them that, or you know, put them in a separate category than I would U.S. stocks.
Yes, yeah. A question. I have a question about two of your ideas. I'm way over here on the outer 40. I have a question about two ideas that seem in conflict to me. One is, there's an idea that the market seems to be a lot luck, and advising seems to be a lot luck, up and down, flipping of a coin, a random walk down Wall Street, et cetera, which makes sense to me. But that then doesn't make sense to me that the variance of the return could grow over time. If I flip a coin a lot, I know that it's going to approach a probability of a half. Your climate change example would get worse over time because it's a coin that's not even. So I guess I'm a little confused in the level three investing idea is if you hold equities for a long period of time, you're gonna have some assurance that it's going to revert to its historical growth rate of 6% or 7% or whatever it is. So That business about variance growing over time for equities and it being a process of luck seem at odds to me.
Understood. So there are a couple things. The reason the variance will grow, there are a couple reasons. One is that our emotions end up playing a role above and beyond the chance. If everything was a matter of pure chance, I think some of the conclusions you draw there would apply. But also, notice that when we're talking about the range of consequences, for example, for climate change, we're now going beyond looking at whether an active manager beats the market or not. Now we're looking at whether the market as a whole does well or not. So you have to separate two things. One is the market may be awful for the next 10 years, but we still have the question is, did the advisor do better than the market? He may still have lost money, but maybe not as much. So when we're talking about things like climate change, we're talking about a range of possible outcomes in which one of which is that the market goes to zero, let's say. Hopefully the advisor you follow will do better than going to zero, but nonetheless, you still have lost money. Yeah.
Given your assumptions and findings, what is your opinion on AI systems and some of the new automated systems for selection?
What is my opinion about AI systems and automated systems? Some of them may work, but I'm a cynic. So the reason I say that is that if you were the only one to have applied an AI system and no one else was doing it, I think you probably could gain an advantage. But the advantages that a lot of these systems are getting are more microstructure advantages, where they're either beating the order flow or things like that. I don't know that they're able to guess which stocks are better or worse than others. I don't know that just because it's machine driven that it does any better. In fact, some of these machines panic and sell and then ask questions later, just like human beings. So.
Wondering what you think of a simple approach like just following the S&P 500 or a set of index funds or index ETFs that are based on indices, like small cap or value or any of those index approaches seems to me a simple way to go.
Right. Well, I'm glad you asked the question because I need to say that, the answer to all my depressing lessons is not doing nothing, right? And there's always the risk of giving these lessons and people go out and say, I should just put my money in a mattress and do nothing else, which is clearly not the right thing to do. The reason that I tend to be exaggerating in my depression is that I find that groups of investors, even AAII investors, tend to be overconfident about their abilities. So I'm trying to be a corrective against that. If I came to a meeting in which everyone was sort of, moping around the floor and barely able to get themselves up even in their chairs and said everything was hopeless, I might give a different talk. You're right, but that's not the situation in which we live, especially at the top of a bull market. Everyone is very inflated in terms of what they think will work, and they don't think risk is anywhere near as great as it otherwise could be. John and I were talking about this earlier, is that, the last 10 years prior to this column, which I said that normally you get a 5% drawback in the market on a daily basis once every, I think it was 1.9 years on average, and we'd gone 10 years without a 5% drawback. And even though that's not a prediction that we would have one, even though the headline writer at MarketWatch made it into a prediction and I was right by mistake, nonetheless, it does underline we have been spoiled. Volatility has been extraordinarily low relative to any historical measure. And here we are 10 years into a bull market and memories of the bear market in 2007-09 are starting to fade. And for that reason, I think people probably are overinflated as to their abilities. And so for that reason, having some humility about the range of things over which we have no control and don't even know that we don't have control over is probably a good backstop. That's the reason I gave the talk. But so back to your question, I have my money in an index fund. So it's not like I have my money in a mattress. There are ways in which you can maximize a scenario, even if you don't have 100% confidence that scenario will come to pass. But so you know, there are things that are easier said not to do than it is to say what you should do, right? It's very obvious that you shouldn't overtrade. And yeah, people do, of course. But nonetheless, that was sort of the message of Harold Pollack's talk yesterday, is that, you know, it's obvious that if you have high fees and are high transaction costs and you're trading all the time, you're going to lose over time. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to tell you that. So you don't want to do that. So you're saying buy the S&P and hold it through thick and thin. That's great if you can hold it through thick and thin. My experience is that a lot of people at the last stages of a bull market all of a sudden start genuflecting at the altar of buy and hold, and then they throw in the towel at the bottom of the next bear market and say, well, I didn't really mean it, right? So they become latter-day converts at the precise time they should become market timers, if there ever was a time to become a market timer, which I'm not saying you should. But the point is that the shift between belief and buy and hold versus market timing itself goes through a behavioral cycle. And so at the top of a bull market, you'll find yourself saying, you know what, I should believe that every correction is a time to put more money in, that no correction will begin in a new bear market and that sort of thing, because that's what history has taught us, right? And then we'll learn better, and then it'll take us years to creep back into the market and so forth. It's been forever thus. But anyway, I hope that answered your question. I think I'm over time, too.
I have one last question.
One last question. Where are we?
Yes. Since you spent your career on newsletters, are there any towards the end that you feel were worthwhile in the newsletter business?
Do I feel that there are any newsletters worthwhile? Absolutely. And some of them that are worthwhile haven't necessarily beaten the market. This is back to my point, lesson number 6 in my iteration of them, was that that they have helped their clients get where they want to go. There's a way in which having an advisor helps you through the dark days that an index fund's not going to help you. Now, it'd be one thing for me to tell you, you know what, you know, you shouldn't need your hand held through a bear market. But a lot of people do. I remember it was actually at an AAI conference years ago that was Donahue. Bill Donahue had a great line, which he says, it was in Washington, D.C. It was right near the red light district. The great line, he says, you can go out outside this door and get a lot more than your hand held for a lot less than 1%. So, so we can make fun of the fact that people want their hand held through a bear market. But nonetheless, people do. And so if a newsletter can help a client get where they want to go, I say all power to them. That's where the psychological dimension is so important rather than look at statistics alone. Well, I can't name all of them right now. If you go to my website, hulbertratings.com, and I have scoreboards that are free of charge, and you can look at them there. But there are a number of them. And you'll see a range. Some are very low risk, some are high risk. But the ones there, you'll see a number of them that have very good returns. I think that's it. Okay, thank you very much.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.